We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. It is the day of the month that we talk about money management on the show, something we've been doing on a regular basis for quite a long time. On a Friday, Dave Sinnoh is the guest. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And when he's here, we try to help you out with questions that have to do with financial planning and investing in money management. He'll talk about a couple things here to start us off. And then if you have questions about that or anything else, he'll do his best to help you out. Hey, welcome back.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, let's talk about inflation this morning. And a number of my remarks are actually taken from yesterday's Associated Press article on consumer prices. It was written by Christopher Rugabar. Did an excellent job sort of summing up a lot of issues with inflation. So I'll quote a bit from his article as well as paraphrase some things. And obviously, it's no secret, David, that consumers are paying more every month for everything, from food and gas to airline tickets, clothing, you name it, we're seeing increasing inflation. Now, it was reported that the consumer price index rose 0.4% last month, and that's also matching December's increase. So when we think about it, 0.4 in December, 0.4 in January, I don't like that trend. And in fact, over the past year, the index has risen some 1.6%. And of course, while it affects us in America, it has just extraordinary effects internationally. Food prices have risen 29% in the past year globally, according to a World Bank report Tuesday. And this is just 3% below the all-time high. Higher food prices are pushing overall inflation up in developing countries and probably substantially contributing to political unrest. China just this week said we've got to raise interest rates, we've got to change reserve requirements. So China just raised the reserve requirements on banks by 50 basis points. In other words, about 20 cents now of every dollar deposited in China banks are in reserve. That means they can't be loaned out. So China is trying to take very aggressive actions to stem the, well, substantial inflationary tide in that country. And of course, the impact has really been much smaller in the United States. Americans, for example, when it comes to food, spend a smaller proportion of their budget on food, about 14%, compared to 40 to 50% around the world. And commodity costs make up a similar portion, of course, of food prices. So transportation, processing, and packaging account for a much larger chunk in the United States. So big swings in commodity prices globally just have extraordinary impacts on their economies. And as I mentioned, central banks in many countries, including China, Brazil, etc., are trying to take steps to thwart inflation. One of the naughty little problems in China is the cost of real estate. It's just skyrocketing. Month to month, there are indexes that people are following, and these indexes are increasing 5, even 10% per month. It sounds like overheating is taking place in China. I wonder if they're going to be following the U.S. example. Interestingly enough, Fed officials unanimously concluded last month, however, that inflation isn't that big a problem yet in the United States, according to minutes from their January meeting. And the central bank really anticipates annualized inflation to be about 1.7%. Well, of course, it's a big advantage if inflation is low in the United States. For example, we won't have to pay substantial increases in Social Security benefits at the end of the year to some 50 million Americans who are accessing Social Security. Generally, the direction of interest rates follows inflation rates. So if inflation rates remain, quote unquote, dampened down, then interest rates on our Treasury instruments remain dampened down, which means that a smaller percentage of our overall spending has to go to the holders of treasuries in terms of interest rates. So imagine if inflation starts to really take off in this country. It's followed by dramatically increasing interest rates. What does that do to the total dollars that our federal budget and federal folks are going to spend? It means more money going to Social Security recipients and a whole lot more on the national debt because of interest payments. That's a gigantic problem looming down the road. Other prices are obviously rising. Clothing, we all know about that. My goodness, imagine, I was shocked, David, walking into a store, looking for T-shirts, three pair of T-shirts, $20. Thank God my wife Carol shops for me because I think, obviously, I don't know. I'd probably go home and go to bed or something at those prices. Airline fares increased for the fifth straight month in a row. Airlines are paying about 50% more for fuel than they did just a year ago. Gas prices, we all know the story. And gas prices, that rose at least 3.5% on average in January. The cost of housing, which it makes up really about 40% of the core indexes which the government is quoting, that basically was delta neutral. It's rising very, very slightly, not because housing prices are increasing, but because rents are slowly increasing. More and more people leaving their homes, more and more people renting. That does have some upward pressure on rents. Interestingly enough, some goods are actually cheaper. New and used car prices actually fell. Hotel prices, I don't know the last time someone stayed at a hotel, but hotel prices dropped 1%. Computer and technology equipment continue to fall. Television sets continue to fall down some 0.8%. Well, if you believe that inflation is starting to truly rear its ugly head and that we are looking at more inflation down the road, how do we insulate a portfolio? What in the world can we do? How can we invest, for example, to deal with inflation? Now, one possibility is to dollar cost average into a mutual fund or ETF index which mirrors commodities. That's a possibility. And probably, and I'm looking at this seriously for my own clients, is to purchase something called the USCI. The U.S. Commodity Index. That's an exchange-traded fund. It's an ETF. You can go to a brokerage, your brokerage house, and it's easily purchased. And it provides exposure to a broad range of commodities, including things like gold and silver, gas and oil, grains, even cotton, which, of course, is on fire. Now, I caution folks because, again, you have some of this exposure just by being in certain other types of portfolios. But if you want direct exposure, this is one way of enhancing it if you believe inflation is just down the road. And again, I caution people that if they're going to purchase this kind of index, this kind of ETF, they need to dollar cost average. So, for example, they look at their portfolio and say, how much of my portfolio would it be intelligent to put into this kind of index? Maybe 5%, maybe 7%. I doubt whether very much more than that. All right, I'm going to make a commitment over the next 12 months, 15 months to dollar cost average 5% of my overall portfolio, maybe 7, maybe even as much as 10. I feel more comfortable with a 5 to 7% commitment in such a portfolio. All right, so that's a possibility. If you're a gold bug, well, and there are a lot of gold bugs out there. It's very difficult for me to recommend it. But nevertheless, there are any number of ways of accessing gold. And probably the simplest way is to buy something called GLD. That also is an exchange-traded fund. And that is actually backed by real gold holdings. So at least they tell us that. And if you want direct exposure, that's one way of doing that. Some analysts, on the other hand, are saying, you know, if inflation increases, that means interest rates are going to go up. And if interest rates go up, companies that have low leverage, companies that are not carrying tremendous amounts of debt on their balance sheet, will not be as negatively impacted because they won't have to pay as much interest. So one possibility is look for companies that have very low leverage on their balance sheets now. And interestingly enough, a number of those are well-known technology companies. A number of them are well-known even industrial companies. So you could ask your broker, you could go and screen these yourself, and look for companies that have very positive balance sheets, very low leverage balance sheets, because those are companies that will survive and may even prosper because they don't have to go out and borrow a lot of money. I guess the final answer is we'll stay tuned. I think we're going to start monitoring this much more carefully on a month-to-month basis because, very frankly, it looks like the government, it has a vested interest in perhaps reporting these numbers in such a way that is a benefit to our national debt and a benefit where we don't have to pay out, for example, to our Social Security recipients. All right, that's point number one. Point number two, every month we take a quick spin down Couch Potato Lane, and we're going to look at our Couch Potato portfolio. Now, recall that it is made up of 8 index funds. A number of questions have recently come in and said, Dave, what are the specific names or numbers of those funds? First of all, these are Vanguard funds. If you go to the Vanguard Family of Mutual Funds, that particular site, you can click on mutual funds, and then you can click on, in the right-hand side, name of mutual funds. And basically, all of these mutual funds come up. The first one that is listed is the S&P fund, and it's called the Index 500 Fund. You'll easily find it at Vanguard. Small cap, U.S. small cap value, mid cap index, REIT, they're all there by name. The only one that might be slightly confusing is if you go to the WILL website and you look at our portfolio, it says U.S. large value. That actual index is called the Value Index. It is a U.S. index, and it is called the Value Index. But otherwise, there shouldn't really be any concern. It's pretty straightforward as to the names of those particular mutual funds. Now, how's it done? Well, year-to-date, through yesterday's close, the Couch Potato portfolio is up just a little north of 6% year-to-date. Our benchmark S&P 500, however, is up 6.8%. So our portfolio this year is actually trailing our benchmark S&P 500. And that is because the international indexes and the emerging market indexes have actually underperformed the U.S. indexes. So while I am a great believer in diversification, more U.S. diversification works so far this year. Just one other matter, if you are following the portfolio, I pointed this out in January. I want to reemphasize it once again. For the first time in several years, we made an asset allocation percentage change. We reduced the emerging markets index from 5% to 2.5%, and we moved that 2.5% to U.S. small cap value. The rationale for that move is that if you look at the total international index at Vanguard, more of that index is comprised of emerging markets. So we didn't want to get overexposed to the emerging markets index. Also, I caution people, remember, this is an equity portfolio. Do not put all of your money into an equity portfolio. Perhaps if you're 18, 19, or 20, and you're not going to access that money for 50 years, okay. But for most of us, we're growing older by the day. Apparently, we're growing grayer by the day. And as a result, we have to be careful in terms of our allocation. So this might represent 40% of your overall portfolio. It might represent 50. That's something you have to discuss with your individual advisor. You still have to have the basics. You need a savings account. You need a money market account. You probably need some basic life insurance coverages, etc., depending upon your situation. So this is only one piece of the portfolio pie. So there you have it, David. Inflation, stocks. I'd be happy to tackle any issues, any questions on the minds of our listeners.
All right. David Sinnoh is our guest. He is a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. And once a month, always on Friday, we do these shows and we talk about personal finance and money management. If you have questions on anything that he's discussed here or anything else that has to do with managing your money, give us a call and share the specifics as much as you want, and Dave will see if he can give you some advice. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You may also send emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me just ask you a quick question here.
Sure.
You know, the beauty of the couch potato portfolio is that you set it and forget it.
Absolutely.
With the exception of once a year, we always say, when you come to the end of the year, you want to look at your allocations and say, okay, is this good? We want to sit here. Do we want to make some adjustments? And I'm just now curious because given what you said about the increase, particularly in commodity prices, stuff we eat and stuff we wear, whether and your suggestion that what you could do with some of your money would be to put it essentially into a fund that looks at these things. I wonder if you think by the end of the year you might be thinking about adding something like that to your portfolio.
I may very well add something like that to my portfolio. And if I did, I would average in, as I say, about 5 to 7% of the money, which would require a pro rata reduction, if you will, in these various other percentages.
You wouldn't take anything out. You'd maybe thinking you might actually add one.
Absolutely. Yeah. But if I was going to reposition and I said, well, I already have this finite amount of money and that's all I really have to invest, then I would probably sell down a pro rata percentage of each of these so that I could average in. And again, I wouldn't put all of that money in one day. It would be just my luck the day that I went in that the entire index exploded and suddenly I was down 20 or 25%, and that would make me a little bit unhappy. So I would probably move that money into a money market fund, and then I would average in over a period of time, maybe 6, maybe 12 months. It just really, really depends on one's individual situation.
Yeah, and that's the thing you got to watch with. Commodities can be very, very volatile, so one has to be careful.
Yeah. Something else I want to talk about, it's bothersome. Most people don't realize this, and it really involves the financial viability of our banking system. It's estimated, for example, this year when I did my research, it looks like another 1 million homes are going to be foreclosed, which really means that banks are sitting on enormous numbers of loans that are going to be foreclosed. Interestingly enough, if you look at bank balance sheets, under current rules and regulations, banks are able to list those loans at face value as an asset on their balance sheets. Let me explain. You have a $200,000 loan on your books. You can list that as an asset at $200,000 on your bank balance sheet. And indeed, most banks are still what is referred to as marking to the market, but their market is what the outstanding value of that loan is, knowing full well when that property gets foreclosed, it might be half. So this is just a huge problem that is still existing on bank balance sheets across the country. So the Federal Reserve wants to keep interest rates very, very low. So we deposit our money at financial institutions, which we've been doing, earning our customary, 0.2%, 0.3%. The banks are taking that money, partially loaning it to their best customers. But what they're really doing is going out and buying treasuries, paper, and earning a spread, and once again, still rebuilding their balance sheets, knowing full well that as these foreclosures unwind, and it looks like 2011 and 2012 is going to be a lot of unwinding of these particular kinds of loans, that banks are hopeful that this spread is going to be able to ameliorate the impact of these foreclosures because they are just way overvalued in terms of assets on the bank balance sheet. And this is true across the country. This is true at money center banks, and it continues, and it is so bothersome when we see the literally billions of dollars that are being paid out in bonuses and dividends to major players in banks around the country. And no one is speaking up about this. And again, I feel that it should be brought to the public's attention So we are in a very fragile state of time still with the American banking industry. Make no mistake about it, which means that we still could have very, very substantial swings in stock market prices, either up or down. It's still a very volatile time. We still have a fragile economy. Okay.
Well, we have a caller here, and we'd certainly welcome others. You'd like to talk with Dave Sinnoh, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email. You can write to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And here's a caller in Morton Grove, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, Dr. Sinnoh. Good to hear you again.
Thank you.
I called in last month with a question about the farm products and how I might tap them. And your comment today about U.S. Commodities Index seems to be an answer to that. I was wondering, I didn't want to assume, but I know you said you were going to look into something about that last month.
Well, I did. And interestingly enough, two or three of our listeners were gracious enough to send me further information on various investment vehicles that are available that specifically invest in farmlands and or commodity. I did more research on those particular investment vehicles, and I'm a little bit loath to recommend them.
Oh,
I want some because they were either relatively new or, in the alternative, they really were very, very small in size, so there was an issue of liquidity.
Yes.
So one of the advantages, for example, of being in something like the USCI, it is heavily traded, which means there is substantial liquidity day to day. So when you buy, you obviously can sell at the same time.
Uh-huh.
So one of the things that one has to look at when they get involved in something called ETFs, exchange-traded funds, generally you want to see an ETF with some size, because otherwise these ETFs can run into issues of liquidity, and there can be extremely broad price swings in any given day. So that's why I favor something like the U.S. Commodities Index, the USCI. It's in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It's been around a while. It tries to mirror certain benchmarks, and that may be something that would be appropriate. And again, I would caution everyone, you would want to average into that kind of position.
Yes, and I have to tell you that knowing you looked into it and gives me a certain amount of comfort, and I'll stay away from the ones you said to stay away from, and I will dip my toe into the one you did suggest, and I think that'll do me just fine.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, if you just simply access the Internet, Google Bing, USCI, and you will find a number of sites that will come up, and you can take a careful look at that particular ETF, note all of the different items that comprise the basket of commodities that make up that particular index.
Yes, yes, that's perfect for my my thoughts as well as my future plans. So I want to thank you for taking the time to do that, and I'll be happy to continue listening to the program.
My pleasure, and thanks very much.
All right, let's go to Belgium. Another caller here, line 1. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning, sir.
It's getting close to fishing time, Mr. Sinnoh.
Yes, it is.
It's getting real close.
Thank you.
Yesterday on Mr. Inge's show, he had a gentleman that was talking about the financial situation in the state of Illinois, or around, I guess. And I asked him a question I'd like to ask you. He didn't really answer it much. He just said it was a good question. What happens when a state goes bankrupt? Since Illinois is probably the leading candidate to be the first one to do that at this point in time, what would happen? And now I know there might be some kind of congressional situation or some kind of legal things that says states literally cannot go bankrupt. They might have to pay in scrip. They might have to do something bizarre like that. But what really happens? I know our bond ratings go up. But if the point comes that they're so bad that nobody wants to buy the bonds anymore, you still have the problem. What do we do?
I think your listener probably coined the word, it's a great question. I think, number one, we are effectively bankrupt at the moment. Let's face facts. We are effectively bankrupt. We continue to have a negative cash flow every month, and we have outstanding in excess of $10 billion, I believe, of back payments to be made. Now, if that were you or I believe that we would either be declaring Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. So we would either have to reorganize, but probably it would be a liquidation. So let's be honest that currently the state of Illinois is effectively bankrupt in the classic sense of the word. So what is the state of Illinois doing? Well, one, they're attempting, at least under Mr. Quinn's proposed budget, to borrow money. And interestingly enough, there are a number of companies, funds, investors who are willing to continue to buy Illinois paper. But it's going to cost us dearly, much higher interest rates than market interest rates. So clearly, as a state, we would be borrowing at much higher interest rates and even further mortgaging our future. So that is clearly one issue. You're raising the issue of, at some point in time, will anyone even loan money to the state of Illinois? Well, currently, even in California, even in certain other states, that there have been investors who are willing to invest. Secondly, as a result of the tax increase that has taken place in the state of Illinois, a couple of things tremendously bother me about the state increase. One is, it's not graduated. There are a tremendous number of people in the state of Illinois who are earning somewhere between $15,000 and $30,000 as a family. It is absolutely horrific, it seems to me, that those folks who can least afford it are being forced to pay another 2% in income tax. They simply can't afford it. And not only that, it doesn't make good economic sense. It's taking 2% out of the economy and simply putting it in government's hands, and that velocity of money does not create jobs. It doesn't create jobs. So I think that is very short-sighted. I find it very interesting, for example, that in the Feds, we have a 2% Social Security decrease for 1 year, and we turn right around and we increase Illinois state income tax by 2%. I wonder if there is a connection there. In addition, over the last several weeks, I have talked to a number of prominent small business people. Now, these people aren't billionaires. These are people who have businesses anywhere from 25 employees up to 500 employees. And I've talked to a number of them, and they are just livid, just absolutely livid about this income tax increase. They basically all have what are called subchapter S corporations, because that's the way most small businesses are set up, so there isn't double taxation. And then all of the income from the business flows back to them to the extent there is a profit. And they are just all telling me the same thing, that while they are likely to keep their businesses in the state of Illinois, there is a personal disincentive for them to live in the state of Illinois and now pay state income tax at the rate of 5% when they can move a number of places and pay no state income tax. And they're very, very concerned about this. This is popping up all over the state of Illinois. So my best guess is that the state income tax increase, which has now been levied, is going to bring in far less money, far less than was actuarially predicted. Now, I'm not really answering your question, what happens in bankruptcy, because no one knows what will happen in bankruptcy. Usually, in personal bankruptcy, we're forced to sell off personal assets. So we would have to look at state of Illinois assets. For example, would we be now selling off state parkland? Right? That is an asset. And interestingly, when we look at a balance sheet, we generally don't consider the assets of a particular state or the federal government. We always look at the deficits. So would we be selling off state of Illinois parkland? Would we be selling off the buildings that the state of Illinois owns and then renting them back? So these are all questions. I don't know the answers. I just know some of the questions to ask. What do you think would happen?
Well, sir, I'm afraid we're I'm afraid we're really looking down the wrong path here, to be completely honest. As far as state sales, income tax go, we're not really the highest by any stretch of imagination. There's a few states that doesn't have any. I understand that you could go to those places. I think the true problem, and I think a lot of businessmen, if they really thought about it seriously, the true problem that we could solve a lot with here is to change our workman comp laws.
No question. No question.
We could bring a lot more business here just by doing that.
I couldn't agree with you more. You are preaching to the choir. We have the second highest workman's compensation rates in the United States. And why would any business look to Illinois given those rates? And now, coming out of Chicago, some of our state legislators are proposing even a higher minimum wage to $10 an hour. We already have the fourth highest minimum wage in the United States, far higher than the federal rate, and now we're talking about a $10 rate. And the problem when we see these things is that not that that's necessarily going to happen, but there seems to be such a political disconnect between these politicians and growing an economy. It's just very, very distressing to me personally that these folks just don't seem to understand economics 101 and how we create jobs. 9 out of every 10 jobs in America are created by small business. But unfortunately today, when a Fortune 1000 company creates a job, 6 out of every 10 jobs created by major companies are jobs that are created abroad. They're not created in the good old U.S. of A. So we have so many anti-business types of programs and provisions that are institutionalized. It's very, very difficult for the state of Illinois. So I couldn't agree with you more.
The other thing I notice, and this may seem far-fetched to a lot of people, maybe a lot of Mr. Inge's listeners, but, you know, the problem we see in the Middle East is a problem that we can face ourselves, because as unemployment becomes higher and higher, you have more people sitting around with nothing to do, and they start thinking about having problems. And you see somebody that's making $1 billion a year, you start saying, it's time to start throwing rocks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The windows need to be broken.
Well, that's right. And I've talked about this before, that as more and more wealth becomes concentrated among fewer and fewer people, that we have a diminishing middle class. We can argue about whether there is a diminishing middle class all day long. There are statistics pointing both ways. But the bottom line is that it seems to be pretty incontrovertible that when we add up the number of people who are actually unemployed looking for a job, the number of people who are underemployed in this country, and the number of people who have just dropped out, that's somewhere between 16 and 20% of the American workforce. People can argue about those statistics, but it's somewhere in between. That's an awful lot of people who can get angry and put tremendous political pressure on our system. And that's something that we really need to be very concerned about, because historically the United States, if anything, and the reason that our currency and our American dollar is still considered the currency for basing all kinds of global prices is because of the stability of our political regime. We still have a basic value that we are a democratic society. We vote. We don't go to the streets. All you have to do is look at the state of Wisconsin and all of those pictures. That was pretty nasty business up there, the state house in Madison. You probably saw the same pictures I did. Okay. So I'm agreeing with you. You're preaching to the choir.
All right. We got 15 minutes left or so here in this part of Focus. Our guest is David Sinow. He is here on the program once a month. He's a professor here, a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. And we do these shows. And they're really, if people want to talk about macro issues, that's certainly fine. But we really do these shows primarily for people to call in and ask specific questions about their own financial planning and trying to get some advice. So either way, 333-9455. A toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Have somebody here in Coles County next. Line 4.
Yes.
Hello? Yes.
You've mentioned the negatives related to the income tax increase. And, of course, I agree with you that if there was going to be an increase, that it should have been a progressive tax, not the flat rate tax. But I just have a question. You mentioned the negatives related to the income tax increase, and I'm sure that you were correct in a lot of what you said. But wouldn't the situation be even more catastrophic without a tax increase at all?
I think in the short run, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because we would be further and further behind in our bills. So we clearly needed some revenue in the short run. So I'm not objecting. I am objecting to the progressivity issue, and you and I are on the same page on that.
Okay.
I think in the long run, however, when we're raising taxes, especially on small businesses, I think that's going to have a very, very negative impact over longer periods of time. We have some structural issues we need to deal with, and that is the tax ability of our citizens, especially on small business, workman's compensation issues, minimum wage issues. Illinois is not a friendly environment right now to do business, and we have surrounding states that are more friendly for attracting business. And it's a shame because we are the center of the country. We have the second or first largest, busiest airport in the United States. We have excellent interstates and transportation systems, and there just is no good reason. There is no good reason that we can't solve these economic issues.
Yeah, just yesterday, the caller from Belgium was talking about the show we did yesterday. The guest was Bob Rich.
Okay.
You know Bob, I'm sure.
Sure.
Bob Rich, who is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And we were talking about the state budget situation, and a number of things came up. One of the things that we did talk indeed about was the tax structure that we have. And it is true, I think, that there are a lot of people who would like to see that changed. Just one point that's worth making is that to go from a flat tax to a progressive tax would require changing the Illinois Constitution.
Absolutely.
Which is extraordinarily difficult to do. So that seems the likelihood of that, I would say, the probability is pretty low that such a thing would happen, even though there are many people who think that that would actually be a good thing to do.
Absolutely.
You know, the other thing that I was really struck by, the Institute has now for 5 years been putting out something that they call the Illinois Report. People can read it on their website. They can get a hard copy. And it looks at various aspects of Illinois government. And certainly they, in the past several reports, they've spent a lot of time writing about the budget. And one of the things that was very striking, if you look at the business climate in Illinois, one of the things that they did was they have a graph there that looks at job growth nationally and job growth in the state of Illinois. And their numbers that they presented went back all the way to, I think, 1980. And one of the things that you can see is that job growth in Illinois has significantly lagged behind job growth nationally going all the way back to 1980. And it just and the gap between the two lines widens as you go out in time. And I was very, very curious about that. Well, what's the issue with job creation in Illinois? And obviously, whatever it is, it's the problem is not a recent problem. It's a problem that
goes
back decades.
It's an institutional problem that has gone back for a long period of time. And in fact, when we have gone through the recent recessions and we have had recoveries since 1980, you're absolutely right. The recoveries in Illinois have been substantially less than recoveries in other parts of the country.
Mm. And that's, I think this is something that certainly we've talked about this with Fred Gertz before. Other economists here at the University of Illinois have also tracked that even once things turn around nationally, the state of Illinois, our economy lags behind. So that makes it seem as if we're going to be dealing with some very difficult conditions here in the state of Illinois for several years to come, who knows how many. Well, that, though, gets this question, also gets the question, well, if things do turn around, will that help? To what extent can we expect that to help with our financial problems in the state? What do you see as the likelihood of the state economy improving to the extent that would result in some significant increase in revenues coming into the state of Illinois?
Well, at the moment, I don't see a significant increase in revenues to the state of Illinois. And this is just a huge problem for the governor. It's a huge problem for the legislature, et cetera. So their quick fix, of course, was in the middle of the night when no one was looking, is to pass a tax increase by one vote. And isn't it interesting, and I'm not going to go there politically, but there's a lot of talk about the who cast the deciding vote and that nature of that relationship with Mr. Quinn and Jobs. But let's not go there and talk about that. That's another day and another story. It's an enormous problem. We have to work on fixing the business environment. That's number one. And number two, looking at where we can cut spending, where we can cut spending intelligently. It's certainly not necessarily in education. Don't think that makes a lot of sense. So, and David, I don't have the answers. So I want, let's switch back to financial planning.
Okay.
All right. Then my stomach and my blood pressure will be better. Yeah. I want to talk very, very quickly about estate taxes. Now, under the new federal rules, one can pass $5 million of net worth totally free of estate tax. And then after $5 million, David, a person like yourself, when you pass that money, then the next dollar would be taxed at 35%. The question always comes up, however, all right, that's the federal rule. What happens in terms of, those are called federal estate taxes. What happens in terms of inheritance taxes? For example, maybe I'm a resident of Michigan. Maybe I'm a resident of Illinois. Maybe I'm a resident of California. Okay? Those rules differ state by state. Inheritance taxes are taxes on the recipient of the money. And some states just simply mirror the federal law. Illinois, interestingly enough, has decoupled from the federal law, and that is that Illinois enables an individual to essentially leave $2 million inheritance tax free to beneficiaries of their largesse. After $2 million, now we start having a percentage applied, and it moves up pretty rapidly, 3, 7, 9, 11, 15, etc. So it can become a very burdensome tax. And this can impact farm families because of the rapid, rapid inflation in the price of farmland. So I would urge people who have an estate in excess of $2 million to essentially consult with their estate planning attorney to see whether or not they are at least set up reasonably well to avoid inheritance taxes. Because, and again, this is for wealthier families, not for most of us, but for wealthier families. So that's something to consider about federal estate tax. The other thing about federal estate tax, those new $5 million rules and the 35% rule are apparently going to be around for the next 24 months. Then after that, we're sort of back again to trying to figure out what's going to happen next. And a lot of people are already suggesting we should go back to the old $3.5 million rule, which was in effect in 2009, and even increasing then the estate tax rate from 35 back to perhaps 45%. So stay tuned for that. That's just another battle down the road, et cetera. Something else about Social Security taxes that are often misunderstood, and I want to point this out, this 2% decrease in the amount of Social Security or payroll taxes that many people are facing is a one-year phenomenon. Currently, if you are working in the private sector and somewhat in the public sector, if you are subject to payroll tax withholding for Social Security, the old rule was, well, 6.2% of my payroll on the first $106,800 would be withheld for Social Security. This year, it's 4.2%. Now, it did not change for employers. Employers are still required to withhold the 6.2%. So this is a one-time benefit for employees. The theory being, well, if I make $50,000 and I pay 2% less tax, that's $1,000 in my pocket. And that $1,000, presumably, I'm going to spend. And it is going to be spent either purchasing durable goods, purchasing consumer goods, etc., thereby giving a boost to the economy. Now, this has only been impactful since January, so we're going to have to wait and see what kind of impact, if any, this is going to have on the economy. But at least in the short run, it is a benefit for people who are paying payroll taxes.
All right. We have about 5 minutes here left. If somebody wants to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
Let's talk briefly about housing and mortgage rates.
Oh, good.
They are trending up. Just 6 months ago, a 30-year mortgage could be procured at an interest rate of about 4.25%. We're now north of 5%. The typical mortgage interest rate is triggered by the 10-year Treasury. So we look at the rate paid on the 10-year Treasury, and we generally add somewhere between 1.5% and 2.5% to that rate to get an idea of what mortgage rates are. Now, historically, when we look at a 5% mortgage rate, maybe today that turns some people off, but historically that's been a great rate. It's still a wonderful rate to lock in 5% for 30 years because even in inflation, you'd be paying back in cheaper dollars.
All right. Now, we do have some calls, and we'll try to get one or both. Bradley, Illinois, is next, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This was a call in follow-up to your discussion about estate taxes, possibly with families that have farmland. Our family has some farmland. We have six children. And we are just now looking at forming a corporation or a trust with the children to try to make that flow to them after my wife and I die. Probably it would be in excess of the current limits, and there would be some inheritance tax if the rules continue as it currently stands. Would you have any recommendations for the choices or options of trust or family corporation?
Well, there are a number of options. You might consider something as unique as a family limited partnership or a limited liability company. In a family limited partnership, you and your wife are the general partners, and you control entirety the partnership. You could also set up a limited liability company to do the same thing. You would essentially, this is a legal entity, and you would then deed your land into this legal entity. There is no tax impact doing that because you are a 100% owner before and you're a 100% owner afterwards. And then you would start gifting on a regular basis, on an annual basis, essentially to your children. And since you have six children, you and your wife, under current gift laws, could gift $26,000 of value each year to as many people as you want. So essentially, you could gift $156,000 of value each year. And here's the good part. You are the managing members of the limited liability company, or you are the managing general partners. And as so long as one of you are alive, you control all of the decision-making with respect to that particular legal entity. But it is a way of gifting to the children, and you can also include provisions where if a child was divorced, if a child was being besieged by creditors, that there are ways of having those units or those membership interests coming back into the family partnership so you can defeat the interests of creditors and if there was a matter of a nasty divorce. You need to go to an estate planner or a lawyer who specializes in looking at family limited partnerships, limited liability companies, maybe a corporation, but probably one of those two entities is the most likely choice. Hope that helps.
That really does. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll try to do one more. In Urbana, someone on the cell phone, line one. Hello.
Yes, I know you're talking about personal finances, but I have a macro question. You mentioned that the purpose of reducing FICA 2% was to perhaps release money to be spent on capital goods. But how does that help our economy when so many heavy goods, capital goods, I don't remember what you called them, are made overseas? When Bush gave us a tax cut, he hoped we'd spend it, but are we spending it on things made in China?
Well, interestingly enough, this is misunderstood. We are still the largest manufacturing country in the world. So we manufacture a lot of goods here. Unfortunately, we don't manufacture anywhere near what we used to as a function of the total goods produced in the world. But we are still, make no doubt about it, a manufacturing power. So again, at least some of those goods are going to be purchased out of inventories, out of goods that are manufactured in the United States. Not all of them, by any means. So that's the nature of a global economy, and your point certainly is well taken. But nonetheless, it will spur, or it should spur, some job growth in this country.
We're just about the point we have to finish. Any last thing you might like to leave with folks?
Well, lots of great questions today. We sort of got on a macro investment and macro analysis. Lots of issues out there. And what I would say to people is that it's a period of time still to be cautious. The stock market is moving up. There's a lot of euphoria. Don't get caught up in the euphoria. Make certain that in terms of your asset allocation, that you have plenty of short-term assets. So if the stock market suddenly headed south, you weren't put in a position to sell. That would be the big mistake. So again, make certain that you understand that there is danger and that you have to have some short-term assets to weather that storm.
All right. Well, there we'll leave it for this time around. David Sinnoh is with us once a month. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.